Blog Talk Radio.
This is the RF Radio Show with OJ and Gritfish.
Good evening, everyone. It's the same time it was last time you tuned in, and you're listening to the same show, Radio RF. I'm Dreadfish, here with my co-host, your co-host, but not their co-host, ETOJ. So tonight, we're just going to talk about a few different things, among them some stuff. Like the art, which serves as our slideshow for tonight, this show will be a bit abstract, but with enough concreteness that you will hopefully know kind of what's happening, maybe. If you lose your way, that's okay. We probably will, too. And in the words of the great ETOJ, I'm usually lost, but I keep on trucking. Remember, all who wonder are not lost, and we hope that you, too, will keep on trucking with us here at Radio RF.
That's the best intro I think you've done so far. I had to mention that. It might have been the mentioning of quoting of me. You know, that tends to get me excited, though, so
yeah,
I'm a little biased.
It definitely peppered it on. It added some flavor to it. So, speaking of flavor, something completely different. Today, in my network and security class, I've been focusing on security. And for a sort of extra credit thing, my instructor gave us something that, if we can figure it out, then we'll be able to apply 100 points. So we'll get 100 points on either our midterm, which we already took, or the final, which we will take soon. So what he gave us is was two images. They look just the same. And one of them contains a message embedded in it, and it's encoded, and the other does not. So what this is called is steganography. And this is the practice of concealing a file, message, image, or video within another file, message, image, or video. So it's concealing information within information. So I didn't know anything about this whenever I first started. I just started looking at the two pictures back and forth. There were some really tiny differences, and I think that they're mostly just cosmetic and have nothing to do with the thing. I haven't figured it out yet. But I spent a lot of time zooming way in on both of them, searching around, and I think I'm missing the point. So when I was reading about it a little bit, I decided that was the best thing, is to try to understand what it is. It turns out that these kind of things are concealed by changing certain bits in the actual image file. That's something way beyond my understanding, totally over my head. But I spent some time trying to find whatchamacallit. It's called I don't remember the name for the program, but it's something that can, you know, crack a steganography file. And turns out it wouldn't work with a JPEG anyway, but I spent a lot of time trying to get it to work on my command line. So it's going to take a while. I was really giving it a hard shot there for a while, but I just want to solve it for the sake of solving it. He said that, you know, he's not really had any students be able to get it. And so I'm just, you know, I'm determined to get it. It's not so much about the extra credit.
I totally want that 100 points. I'm not even in your class, and I'm going to work on it, so I want that 100 points.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting, though. Like, I just want to crack it and figure it out. But there are some programs, like, while these things are kind of like, you know, you can't see them with the naked eye, they're, you know, computers recognize the differences. Actually, if you go to the Wikipedia page for steganography, that's steganography, you know, ography, you will see an example of two pictures, one that just looks like a tree. It's a photograph of a tree against the skyline, and the picture below that's extracted from the tree image is completely different. It's a cat sitting on a pillow, apparently. It looks a little bit like a GIF. It's lower resolution colors, and so the description says the hidden image is revealed by removing all but the two least significant bits of each color component and a subsequent normalization. I don't know what that means, but it's fascinating.
Yeah, I have even less clue what it says than you are, but I hope you crack the jokes. I look forward to the next installment of this segment.
Yeah, if I do, and if I don't, I'll probably let you guys know, you know, next show.
Speaking of segments, I have talked about gardening a couple of times now, and it's rather pertinent to me right now to mention gardening again, because I live in New Jersey, and at least in my area of New Jersey, we have a frost warning for tonight and tomorrow night. And as I told you last week, I already started planting my garden. Now, most of what I planted, I'm not too worried about being hit by a frost. But it is supposed to freeze for the next 2 days, so I'm going to play it safe. And we're going to use a technique called clutch, or use what we call a clutch, to put over our plants and over our garden, because it should keep it a few degrees warmer. And that should help the plants and the seedlings and the soil itself stay relatively warmer than the freezing temperatures that we're experiencing the next 2 days.
What does that involve exactly?
It's basically, I was explaining it to my neighbor's kids before the show today, and I called it basically the plants and the gardens need a plastic blanket. And that's literally what it is. It's usually a thick piece of like black or clear plastic, like a tarp that you can see through, or like a black tarp. And it locks in the heat, you know, can pull in the sun. Obviously, if you're going to do it for larger periods of time, you'll need to move it each day so the plants get sun and so you can water them. But I plan on just clutching for today and tomorrow, so I'll probably just leave it there until Saturday, and I'll take it off Saturday. I have a tarp, so I'm using tarp for my back garden. And if you remember from last week's episode, that was the garden that was 25 feet long, but I think for the most part, I have a tarp large enough to cover most of it. For the front, I have some of those big black gallon, you know, trash bags or whatever that I'm going to be laying out. Using those, and those are black and thick, so that should be helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, the last frost date is May 5th, so I expect to deal with this until May 5th, so I'm not even mad because I kind of knew this could happen. But Facebook's kind of mad.
Well, we have 1 week, 2 weeks. Man, and it's crazy that it's still so cold lately. But speaking of the gardens, reminded me just, you know, random thought. Today I went by the health food store in town, and I chew those little toothpicks. They have tea tree oil, cassia oil, and menthol in them. Really good.
I use tea tree oil in my house for cleaning.
Yeah, I love tea tree oil. It's supposed to be good for your oral health, and it tastes really good, too. But, you know, health food store has them for sitting outside. And yeah, it's okay. Tea tree oil is antibiotics, probably not the right word for it, but
it's an anti-fungicide. It's a fungicide.
Garlic yes, but I think it also kills bacteria, too. So,
I'm not sure. I usually mix it with garlic myself, or not garlic, with vinegar to make a cleaning mixture.
Yeah.
It's apparently killing out right now. Yay, happy spring, guys.
Yeah, so they say it's spring. Oh, apparently it's capable of killing MRSA. There you go. Random fact.
Wait, what was that?
In vitro studies show that tea tree oil is capable of killing methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA. And it is an antiseptic on a topical application.
Speaking of human genetics, I read today that a Chinese scientist manipulated a human embryo. And I suppose that's the first time a human embryo has been manipulated genetically. Obviously, there is a lot of questions about the ethics. I was more interested in just the science aspect of it right now. I didn't even read the article, so I don't really have any details yet. But that was something that popped up in my newsfeed. I have to save so I can read it tonight.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think I may have read something about that recently or watched it in a video. I guess, you know, I understand the questionable ethics, but I also see that it's pretty much an inevitability that somebody's going to do that. So I guess it might as well be now.
Yeah, that's kind of where it boils down to.
Yeah. Incidentally, speaking of genetic modification, I heard a couple weeks ago, you know, we're generally kind of averse to genetically modified foods and that sort of thing. So interestingly, as many of us have grown up watching Bill Nye the Science Guy, you know, he's still a science personality, he still exists. And so he came out and said that he is no longer totally against genetically modified foods, GMOs. And some people found it suspicious because this was right after he toured a Monsanto facility. But if I remember correctly, the way he put it was it depends on the individual thing. Like, GMOs are not, you know, just inherently bad all around. It depends on the individual application of it. And that makes sense to me.
Absolutely, which is why I think the biggest push recently has been for labeling and better testing. And I think that truly is what this issue should be about. It shouldn't be an anti-GMO crowd. It's irrational. GMOs can be a good thing. The thing is, we need to know what they are, and they need to be verified that they're safe. And at this point, we simply can't guarantee either of those. I mean, maybe for some products, they've been on the market long enough, but ultimately, we're the test animals right now, and that's kind of troublesome. And, like, we're still just finding out how genes work, you know? So we'll find out a gene, oh, this gene controls that, and then 2 years go by, oh, this gene controls 8 other things. Who would have guessed? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. Like, more testing needs to be done, and the labeling. Like, if somebody wants to have it, that's cool, but I think that everybody should be made aware that a certain product contains a genetically modified food, just so people can make that decision.
I do not trust Monsanto, and I think that's fine. Fuck Monsanto.
Yeah, I don't either. I think they're the ones who have been trying to... They're trying to control the food supply, essentially. You know, I don't remember details now. It completely escapes me. But, what they're doing basically just seems like, you know, unethical to me.
Yeah. I think we shared a little bit more into politics than we've meant to. We do plan on getting a little bit more political during the election season because it's kind of inevitable. And it'll definitely draw more interest into the show. So, I mean, we'll definitely talk about that when it's a little bit more relevant. But we try not to get too political because we understand that we have a diverse listening.
We'll try to just express our opinions as our own, but not be inflammatory or anything like that.
Most of the time. I mean, I think we're humans, so sometimes we slip. And I mean, sometimes there's certain topics that either Dredd or I would feel rather passionately about, and it'll be hard to be objective about it, I guess.
True. And this is a good time to remind you that any harm or otherwise undesirable circumstances which you find yourself in as a result of listening to Radio RF, we are not responsible for that.
Unless you like it.
Yes, if you like it, it's okay. Depends on what you're into.
See, this is the judgment-free zone. It's okay, guys.
So, you reminded me that...
Because it's not a gender-neutral word. What's a gender-neutral word? People?
You people? What do you mean, you people? I don't know. I'm okay with it being gender neutral, but that's because I'm a guy, so I guess I'm more indifferent to it. I don't know. I like to try to see both sides of things, but I also understand that a lot of people like to be offended so they can feel kind of righteously victimized or something. I'm not going to make a judgment on this specific thing, though. I don't know enough about it.
You know, actually, a member of ours, Mecca, right? I think it's his name, right? He wrote a blog about that, and I've actually got it saved on my computer. So after the episode, I'll save it I'll edit it into the description, and I'll post it on one of the threads about tonight's episode because it was interesting and it was relevant to what you just said. By the way, everyone, happy belated Earth Day. Yesterday was Earth Day, so happy Earth Day, Dredd.
Happy Earth Day.
Did
I celebrated by living on the earth. You know, I decided to go outside whenever I walked to my car and from my car to class and stuff like that. And but to me, every day is Earth Day, so I just figured I shouldn't do anything special, you know.
That is true. I mean, it is good that we have a day that reminds people to focus on doing things that are better for the environment. But it's important to remember that we should think that way every day. And it's imperative that we do. And you'd be surprised by how much power you alone can have in this kind of conversation. And I have an example at work I'd like to share with you. This was maybe like within the first 3 to 6 months when I started up my company I work for now. And originally they had these blue lights that they used during tours, and then they were just left on even though the other lights were on, and they served no purpose other than aesthetics. And they would just run constantly. We'd use, go through like 20 light bulbs a month. You know, obviously I work at a data center, so we have a huge electricity bill no matter what. But it was extra electricity just being used for no reason at all. And I simply suggested to like my managers and that we get a light switch for it. We can turn the lights off, save money on light bulbs and on power. They passed it up to their managers, and a few months later they applied it, and then a few months after that they applied it to their other building. And now the lights aren't running constantly, or at least that's it. So we're saving, you know, both supply and energy on the planet. And it's little things like that that kind of matter. Obviously, we really need something more from the top. Really, the whole system needs to change in order for anything to actually truly matter. But, I mean, little changes like that do add up, and they are important, and they change the dynamic of how we think and act, and that leads to those important changes we need to get, too. So that's an example
yeah.
of how you, as a person, can actually make a difference.
Yeah, it's good to do individual things, but, you know, a single individual can only make so much of a difference. We need to collectively make our individual efforts, so it's very important. I think, you know, sustainability and things that are good to the earth are really important to me. And, you know, people often think, oh, it's tree hugger, hippie crap. And, but like, it's also simply logical, rational. It's where you live. You should take care of it. You know, you clean your house. Most people do, you know, you don't leave dirt and everything everywhere because it's just unpleasant to live in. It's unhealthy, that sort of thing. So I'm, particularly passionate about finding a way to have clean, sustainable, ethical energy, you know. I think that finding something like that will be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, advanced in human history, because just imagine the possibilities whenever we have basically an unlimited supply of clean, ethical energy. I mean, that's amazing to me.
I mean, I feel in some regards that future is kind of being suppressed by the powers that be for their own financial interest. I'm not saying that we have, like, awesome technology for clean energy now, but we have the potential to do it, and we're simply not utilizing it or investing in it the way that we should be.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Like, you know, the big oil companies, a few of them, like to make us think that they are trying to do that, but also they're really clinging to the oil thing. But speaking of that, in class, you know, I have a technology and society class, and it pretty much involves us just sitting and watching videos for an hour about technology, which is awesome. It's a great class. We recently looked at some energy technology videos, which were really cool. I learned about this city in the United Arab Emirates called Masdar City. And so this is called an arcology project, and arcology is a portmanteau of architecture and ecology. So this is a city, a planned city, that is supposed to be, you know, ecologically sound. I think currently it is carbon neutral. There's only a few hundred people who live in it. I think most of them are apparently university students. But so the way they designed it, you know, it's everything is within walking distance. There aren't cars. The buildings are close together. You know, this is out in the desert. I don't remember the specific temperatures, but while out in the desert, it gets well over 100 right at the ground temperature. In the city, it is right about 100 or just below 100. And all the roofs have solar panels on them to get energy that way. So currently they don't have a way to make energy at night, so they still have to draw on the power the power grid from Abu Dhabi, but during the day they have their own energy. So I think this is amazing. You know, I mean, with there's so much money over there, and with some of the more useless things that the rich guys over there have done, like making islands and resorts, I think this is amazing that somebody's investing in doing this. And I hope that this will end up being a model so that other cities can follow along. Again, I'm totally in love with the idea of having sustainable, you know, environmentally sound infrastructures and that sort of thing. I think it's amazing.
Now, we'll devote a whole episode to my next question, but do you know if they're using permaculture design in that city you're telling us about?
I'm not sure. I don't remember what they talked about with food. I'm not sure if they're growing any food or anything like that.
Well, permaculture is more than just growing food. It's about the way we interact with our environment. I mean, it almost has nothing to do with growing food. People who grow food use permaculture, but it's not inherently related to growing food. It's a really complex subject, and I don't think I could easily give a definition off the top of my head, because it involves multiple layers. I suppose there is one out there. Well, like I said, I think we should actually do a whole episode on this topic. It's kind of important. I think it's kind of the way of the future. But if anyone knows anything more, you can call us at 646-200-4733. Again, that's 646-200-4733. Do you want to – maybe you should play our sex segment. This is 5-Minute Philosophy with Willman.
We shall be discussing philosophy with your host, Well Named.
RF Radio.
Hello, Radio RF. I'm Well Named, and this week we're going to talk about morality and metaethics. So metaethics is the branch of philosophy that's concerned with the nature of moral statements or moral propositions. And a moral proposition is essentially a sentence in the form like, murder is wrong, or you should not murder. That's a moral proposition. And if you've ever heard the terms objective morality or subjective morality, or I don't believe in absolute morality, or relative morality, these are all terms that have to do with metaethics. And in my experience, a lot of times, the meanings of these terms gets a little confused, so the main goal here is just to sort it out a little bit. So, in metaethics in general, the terms objective and subjective are usually replaced with what is called moral realism or anti-realism, or sometimes cognitivism or non-cognitivism. And the idea is that the question fundamentally is about whether or not when I utter a sentence like, it is wrong to murder, am I intending to state a proposition about the world that has a truth value? I'm intending to state something that is a fact of the world either one way or another. So a realist, a moral realist, says that when I say it is wrong to murder, I'm certainly intending to state a fact about the world, and that fact is either, you know, the statement is either true or false. On the other hand, a non-realist, which maps onto subjective morality in our original terms, might look at the statement, it is wrong to murder, and instead hear just an expression of my own feelings, like what I really mean when I say it is wrong to murder is just, I don't like murder, boo murder, that sort of thing. So that's the original sort of separation. Are moral propositions statements about supposed facts? Whether or not there are any facts speak of, do I intend to be saying something that is factual? On the other hand, when you deal with absolute and relative, it's mostly a question of universality without regard for whether or not it's a question of fact. So if I say murder is always wrong, that is a statement that is absolute. It's universal without qualification. Now, usually we hear that in an objective sense, a realist sense, where I'm stating that there is a fact of the matter that murder is always wrong. But it is possible to be an anti-realist and nevertheless be absolute. It's called moral prescriptivism. And I think it's fairly rare, but it's sort of like if I said it's universally true that people feel that murder is wrong, that would sort of be an absolute but non-realist kind of statement. So absoluteness isn't really exactly the same as objectivity. And in the same way, there are moral realists who don't actually believe that there are any facts of the matter. They believe that when I utter the statement, murder is wrong, I'm intending to state a fact, but there are no facts, and in fact, I've just committed an error. So these are called error theorists. So anyway, objective-subjective, realist-anti-realist, you know, absolute-relative. Hopefully this sort of disambiguates the terms a little bit. And there's one final sort of separation that I want to point out, and it's the difference between describing people's moral views as they exist versus trying to arrive at a conclusion about whether or not their a moral statement actually has force to it. So the first is called descriptive ethics. And it's sort of like if I'm an anthropologist and I just go out and interview a bunch of people and find out what they think. I'm not concerned about whether they're right or wrong. I just want to know what they think. I'm just wanting to describe their views. On the other hand, normative ethics is what we mean when we're actually trying to figure out, is it true that murder is wrong? Is there an actual force behind that statement? What ought I to do? The ought is the normative force of a moral statement. And it's important to keep these straight because you might hear someone say, well, if you look out in the world, people have all kinds of different ideas about morality, and therefore there can be no objective morality. There are no moral facts. But this is a confusion between the descriptive mode and the normative mode. It would be like saying people have all kinds of different beliefs about whether climate change is real, therefore there is no actual fact of the matter. But of course, we know that there is a fact of the matter, even if we don't know what it is. And so that's the difference between descriptive and normative ethics. So anyway, I'm Well Named, and this has been 5 Minutes of Philosophy. I wouldn't recommend that you ever bring up metaethics at a party, but if you do, you'll now be even more prepared to annoy all your friends and family.
Thanks again for your segment, as usual. Now, my first reaction was to, well, not my first reaction, but I think the biggest reaction I had was to your comparison to global warming and global warming denying. And at one side, I felt that it was a good comparison and that it kind of made an interesting point, like, I see where you're coming from. I experience that annoyance all the time. So I kind of related to it. But on the other hand, I kind of felt that it was a little bit of an inaccuracy comparison, mostly because I feel one side is demonstrable while another one isn't. But overall, I thought the comparison was pretty solid, and it kind of gave me more of an aha moment. Now, that being said, I guess I'm a moral relativist. How about you, Dredd?
Yeah, I think I was more on the relative as well. I don't think there's some objective law in the universe that says that it's wrong or murder is wrong specifically, but I do think it's a practical thing. Most of the time, that causes more harm than it does good, so it's just something you ought not do, you know?
Yes, I agree. And I suppose you both choose the same kind of standard, I guess, and it's creating suffering or infringing upon others as right or wrong.
Yeah, like, I don't want to suffer, so I'm not going to make any other people suffer either. I don't want to die, so I shouldn't make somebody else die, you know?
That being said, I can't necessarily justify those stances outside of my own feelings about them.
Yeah, like, I can't say that it's just wrong, you know, but this is just the way I feel about it, and if you look at it practically, I mean, I think that it also kind of stands that way, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from a pragmatical point of view, that it just makes sense to have certain moral stances in order to really get anywhere. You kind of need them to function as an individual in a society.
Yeah, and I think that sort of thing probably developed because, or to keep harmony within, you know, human groups. You know, I mean, if you start violence with somebody or if you kill somebody, that really disrupts things, you know. And so, like,
absolutely.
You know, people,
I mean,
like,
we have these social creatures. We're not independent in the slightest. Nothing about the human experience that I would call insular. And I think it's one of the biggest myths of Western ideology is this independence as a self, in the way that we express it currently, at the very least.
Yeah, in the West, you know, we're more of an individualistic culture, and it's not just all in the West, but specifically in America and some of the other Western countries, and, you know, more of the Eastern countries are, and in the past in the West, too, we're more collectivistic, so it's all a lot more about the collective unit than it is the individual person. I think, also to add on that, that could also be reflected in the differences in names. You know, in a lot of the Western languages, we have our given name first and our surname last. And in a lot of Eastern languages, they have the surname first and then the given name.
That's a good point, actually. I wouldn't have had to consider it for. But actually, now think about that. It probably says a lot about the culture, the way names are figured out and formed in their countries and culture.
Yeah.
But there's a study on that. I'm sure some anthropologist or sociologist has studied that. Maybe Orbit knows. Does Orbit know? Is she listening?
I'm
not even
going
to tell her the number. She knows the number
about...
to call.
Yeah, and I actually learned about the individualistic and collectivistic thing in my anthropology class a few years ago, I think. So it's definitely an anthropological thing.
Absolutely. Anthropology is a very fascinating subject, so we expect to talk more about it with Orbit quite frequently because it's a topic I like.
Yeah, at one time I kind of considered that because I really enjoyed that class, but I mean, you know, maybe I'll consider it again in the future. Who knows? Let's see. Well, it looks like ET got disconnected for a moment, so I'm just going to talk to you. So a couple episodes ago, I talked a little bit about password security and information security. I said I was going to do it again in the next episode, and I didn't. This is not because turns out it was boring. I would still do it if that were the case. It's actually because I forgot. That stops me from doing a lot of things. One of the things I had said I would talk about was social engineering. I think we don't often think about this in the context of our information security, our passwords, that sort of thing. So this is actually, it's a very good way to get access to information and accounts, that sort of thing. I had to do a little bit of research for a paper in my security class on this, and I found some interesting case studies. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. The one I really liked was really interesting. This guy told the story. He works for, it was basically like a security consulting firm. And so an employer asked him to, you know, evaluate and try to break the security of their systems. And they specifically wanted to focus on the social engineering aspect of it. So what they did was they got some flash drives. They put some, you know, innocuous regular files on there, but they also put a Trojan on there, which, whenever put into somebody's computer, would gather certain system-specific information and other files on the computer and then send it to them. So when the employees weren't there, they scattered them around in certain areas certain areas that the employees frequented, and then they just sat back and waited. So in this case, they're taking advantage of curiosity.
Ken, right? Orbit called in, so she had the answer to our question we asked before.
Okay, so I'll get back to that in just a minute then. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I heard my name.
Yeah.
And actually, yes, Eastern cultures are more collectivist. The group is way more important than the individual, and the individual is supposed to subsume their individual interests to the interests of the group in order to keep harmony. So you were absolutely right on that account. So I just thought I would call and tell you that.
Cool, thanks. Yeah, I think that's really, it's very obviously demonstrated in places like Japan and China. Especially Japan, shame is a very big thing there. And if you do anything to shame your family, then you're in big trouble. You know, the family is way more important than the individual in that aspect.
We actually had another caller, Dredd.
All right.
Actually, I just stepped out of the room. Were you guys done? I'm sorry, I kind of may have interrupted.
Yeah, we're done. We're done.
Okay,
yeah.
We're done. Perfect. Perfect timing. Now, we had a caller, and the caller had a question for you. So, caller, what was your question?
Good old Dredd. Is your refrigerator running?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if it's running right now. I have to go check.
Well, you should check it.
Well, I did not see that coming.
Also, can I have your job back?
Well, that's a possibility. I don't know. How's that Outback Steakhouse tour going?
Oh, it's dreadful. No pun intended.
I know a lot about Dredd. Well, you know, I suppose all that Foster's beer just didn't cut it, eh?
You know, I thought, I don't know about you, but I thought Mid-Essex was particularly boring. So I thought maybe I'd introduce a new segment about Outback sexuality. What do you think about that?
You know, we could use more sex on our show. Sex sells. We need more viewers, too. But, man, like, we don't want to just
sorry,
be throwing...
Sorry, there's a D-Zo coming. I've got to get out of here, okay? Okay, I'll call you back.
All right, make sure don't eat your baby.
Speaking of people who eat babies, here's today's section by Lewis Knottmiller. For some reason, we refuse to delete any of the songs, segments, or anything you guys submit to us. We have this huge list of songs and segments that we get to look through each time we want to go play one, even though we're never going to play most of them again. And here it is. All right. Here is the beatdown.
This is The Beatdown with Lewis Knottmiller.
G'day, RF. Welcome once again to your favourite online sports segment, The Beatdown, with me, Lewis Knottmiller. Having said that, it's clear that The Beatdown is evolving a little, branching out beyond sports. So as flagged last week, I'm going to start incorporating some interviews with RF members into my segment. As with all beatdown material, the results should be taken with a grain of salt, and that salt should probably be matched with a shot of tequila, to be honest. But today marks the first in a series of segments investigating the history of religious forums. As well as being sports mad, I'm a bit of a history buff, so these segments almost qualify as history. A warning for the uninitiated, I am planning on being pretty fast and loose with the truth, but there's at least some basis in fact on what I'm going to talk about here. Today's topic is a large one. It's likely going to span several shows over the coming weeks, so let me know your thoughts in my thread, RF Radio The Beatdown. And today's topic is the Great Frugal Revolution of 2013. Consider this chapter one, the timeline. So this story starts not in the distant times of 2013, but even further back, in the murky year of 2012. The frugal reform movement managed to get a bill passed which made each frugal given worth a single frugal. To the newer members of the audience, a frugal was basically a like. So I see a post which is worthy and I give it a frugal along with a comment if I wanted to, and that list of comments was available to the people on their profile. So prior to the frugal reform, a member's frugal giving power was related to how many frugals they themselves had. So a newbie could give a single frugal, whereas a veteran who had a huge number of frugals could simply give thousands away for a single like. This led to weird things like frugal orgy threads, where members swapped frugals around, growing exponentially more powerful, with some members literally having millions of frugals. After the frugal reform, the members who already had millions of frugals were basically unassailable. No one would ever be able to amass such frugal hordes again. This imbalance between the frugal whore, I knew I was going to struggle with this word, the frugal whore bourgeoisie and the frugal poor proletariat directly led to the Great Frugal Revolution of 2013. So all of this leads me to today's very, very, very special guest. He was a newcomer to religious forums in 2013, and he was involved to some degree in the machinations of the time, and he's going to help walk us through the timeline of those very confusing days, timeline of the Great Frugal Revolution. Given that this is going to be my first serious journalistic interview, I'm going to put on my serious pants and my serious hard-hitting journalistic voice. So here we go. Welcome to the Beatdown. Today's very special guest, Lewis Knott Miller. Hi. Glad to be here. Before we start, Lewis, have you heard the show before? Are you a fan? Well, I heard a couple of episodes. I mean, it was okay, I guess, but it's a little bit weird, right? I mean, you interviewed the Macho Man last week and he isn't even alive. And you go on and on about the Beta Slayer and his obsession with Hello Kitty. Everyone already knows about that. Right. Well, no weirdness this week. This topic's very serious, so we'll keep things straight. No weirdness, right. Yeah, sure. I'll give you one thing. You are a much better looking dude than I expected. Well, thank you. You're incredibly handsome also, Lewis. Yeah, careful. You're starting to stray into weird again. Right. Noted. Okay, so we're just going to walk through a timeline of events, and I was hoping for your take on them. Yeah, sure.
Timeline, religious forums, May 2013.
Yeah, right. That's an impressive voiceover.
Thanks, Lewis.
So how did all this kick off and when? Well, Mystic Sanger started a thread where she asked people how they were feeling about the one frugal per frugal post world after the Great Reform, just to gauge opinions, have some fun, talk some rubbish. But the first answer to her thread was from a poster called Poison Shady 313.
The father of revolution?
Yeah, exactly. He wasn't called that then, though. He stated, I'm just going to quote this. I wrote it down. I want to make sure I get it right because it was a fulcrum moment in RF history. I think everyone, and I do mean everyone, should have had their frugals adjusted to the number they would have had if the single frugal had been the standard all along. I'm not entirely sure why I feel that way. I just do.
Wow, powerful stuff, Lewis. And this was when?
It was May 16, 2013. I remember it like it was yesterday. Must have checked the archives right before this interview.
And it just snowballed from there?
Yeah, kind of. Quagmire raised the question of a frugal reset the next day.
May 17, 2013.
Well, yeah, that would be the next day, sure. I mean, try to keep up here, right? Anyway, yeah, Quaggy started asking whether a frugal reset was a good idea. No one was really sure how much of this was his idea or whether Naked Ape had taken over his keyboard, which happens from time to time.
So it sounds like everything was heading for a peaceful transition.
Well, like I said, we weren't even sure it was Quagmire posting. Besides, how can you trust the ruling classes? A couple of days later, Nix posted a thread suggesting that RF was being changed by the FR. You know, like a play on words, RF, FR. And so we all started guessing what she meant by FR. Turns out she meant Federal Reserve, and Quagmire was the one who guessed Nix's meaning successfully. I mean, of course he did, right? No surprise there, because he was one of the fat cats in control of the Federal Reserve Bank of Frugals. But I knew what FR should stand for. Frugal Revolution.
And that was when you formed your private army?
No, not straight away. Quagmire asked if veterans would voluntarily reset their frugal counts based on Poison Shady's single frugal per like model. That was when I got a bit worried. Why would the bigwigs voluntarily give up all those frugals? The fix was in, man. The fix was in. Aruberus suggested frugal bailouts for the frugal poor, like everyone with less than 1,000 frugals would get a care package of frugals. But there were people with millions of frugals, man. The top 2% of frugal wealthy posters control 99% of the frugals. Meanwhile, I was supposed to accept frugal stamps so I could get a can of takeaway frugals from the nearest 7-Eleven. What's up with that? And my kids were supposed to survive on hand-me-down frugals that the rich kids were finished with. Mystic Sanger, I mean, this is a bit of a tale I'm telling, but Mystic Sanger was known to bathe in the blood of virgin frugals. Just wasn't right, man.
And so?
Well, so I got together a bunch of smileys and we formed a cadre. We were determined that the frugal revolution would reach its righteous goals.
And what exactly were its righteous goals? Well, Glorious Revolution, of course. But you must have had some specific goals in mind.
Of course we did. We had a specific goal of Glorious Revolution. But the bourgeoisie were cunning. Very bloody cunning. Rather than fight us, they started giving in to our demands. Quagmire had tried placating us with the voluntary frugal reset bullshit offer, and then the rest of the ruling classes started placating us by actually volunteering.
But isn't that a good thing? You were getting your way through peaceful protest.
Exactly. Can you imagine walking into a bar as a member of a peaceful protest? How many chicks are digging on that?
Oh, baby, look at my war wound. I got a paper cut while scribbling on my placard. Sod that. We wanted Glorious Revolution. We wanted war stories and battle scars and groupies. Besides, peace just made my cadre get all weird. What do you mean?
Well, Quagmire announced an uneasy truce between the ruling class pigs and the downtrodden masses, who were now getting their way without a fight. A lot of my revolutionaries decided the war was over, and they started following the Great Dustin instead.
The Great Dustin?
Yeah, the Great Dustin, like he was some sort of god. See, the ruling class pigs had forgotten to reset his frugal count, so now he was wandering around with bags full of frugals, throwing them around like they were scripture in a fundy factory.
Right, scripture in a fundy factory. You know there might be some fundies listening to this, right?
Yeah, right.
As if anyone's listening to this crap. Anyway, so your army deserted without a fight?
Yeah, some. The riffraff.
But I kept the creme de la creme, the elite revolutionaries. And on May the 23rd, 2013, I announced to the world the formation of the People's Democratic Army of Frugal Socialism. We wanted to build on what Poison Shady had started, and we even announced our founding principles.
How large was this army?
Well, it was pretty much me and this little smiley ninja fellow who lived in my sig line for a while.
Okay, that's a little weird.
Yeah, right, like you can talk about weird. Anyway, the founding principles of the People's Democratic Army, Frugal Socialism. I kept the press announcement. I've got it here. I can read it out.
This is what we said.
Whilst we initially believed only the most extreme cases of frugal hoarding were worthy of our attention, unexpected success has led to a massive increase in our already overinflated egos. We now find suspicious anyone who has more frugals than Lewis Knott Miller. Increasing Lewis Knott Miller's frugal account is not an act of treason, but a considered and reasonable socialist action designed to better equalise our frugal society. Anyone disagreeing with these doctrinal positions will immediately be targeted as a member of they and will be subject to intensive re-education by virtue of a democratic shuriken right in the jacksies. Viva la revolution.
Okay, you refer to they. Who are they?
You know, they, them, the ones in power, the shadow masters.
And so did the People's Democratic Army of Frugal Socialism end up finding its glorious revolution?
Oh, yeah, sure. We announced on June the 5th that all posters should only be allowed to accrue one frugal per month until Lewis Knott Miller's frugal count caught up to them. This was seen as an effective and fair way to manage the unfair frugal distribution.
Well, who exactly saw that as effective and fair?
I mean, I did, of course. We weren't successful in getting that put in for some reason. So, to this very day, we remain a downtrodden and disaffected underclass.
Aren't you a mod now?
Oh, yeah, but...
So, did they pay you off or something?
What? No. People's Revolution will never die.
It sounds like you were bought off to me.
Where's your one-man ninja frugal army now?
Actually, I don't know. The last thing I heard, Mystic was asking him if he'd like to donate blood for a good cause.
Right. That's all we have time to cover this week, but we will return to the Great Frugal Revolution in the future. We're currently trying to access archives with actual recordings from the revolution where thousands of people were killed.
Oh, no, hang on. I'm not sure you can say that.
Thousands weren't killed. That's not really true.
Okay, well, how many were killed?
Well, technically, nobody.
Right, so hundreds are injured?
No, not really. Not injured. No one got injured. It's kind of a war of words, you could say. Right. So no one was killed and no one was injured. Could I just say dozens were left grief-stricken? Yeah, that's probably a bit strong. Right. Well, how would you put it? A couple of people got pissed off? Yeah, that's better. Only I wouldn't say pissed off. You wouldn't? No, more like mildly vexed. You want me to lead with the Great Frugal Revolution, where a couple of people got mildly vexed and one newbie poster felt compelled to form a one-smiley ninja army, which deserted him to go out and hang at Mystic's bathtub. Yeah, perfect. Oh, God. All right. I'll try and do better next time, guys, but I don't always have a lot to work with here. Until then, Itty, Dread, back to you guys in the main studio.
And yes, we are still live. Thank you, Lewis Not Miller, for that wonderful section. Now, I did notice you forgot some very important information. That this isn't the first time there's been a revolution in RF. And that is right. As you may remember, I started Revolution RF or Occupy RF, and I even made a user group on the old RF. I don't know if user groups still exist, so I'll look into it. But if there is, there's already a revolution or a user group on RF, led by yours truly, Itta OJ, you know. And yes, unlike Lewis Not Miller, I'm willing to admit they have taken off of power. They're like, if you stop leading the revolution, Itty, we will make you a mod. And I was like, that's all we wanted to begin with, guys. Okay. And I also get paid 3 frubles a day, which I haven't gotten in 3 months, guys. Come on, cough it up, wear them frubles. Bring it up. Come on.
Well, you know what they say. You know, you weren't selling out, you were buying in. Yeah, I remember the Great Frugal Revolution. I was there. That was a really good description. Though graphic, it still does not capture the emotion and the mild vexing which actually happened. I also lost frugals in the revolution. I was more of a mid-class kind of frugalite, and also one of the few who did not have their frugals taken away. And damn my conscience for mentioning it, because I probably could have gone longer with my frugals. If only a little bit more time had been given to me, I probably could have, you know, stowed them away for safekeeping. But they were all gone, and I got lowered to the, you know, the rest of the thing with the commons.
Speaking of safe, keeping safe frugals, I actually do have the last frugal in existence named Frufu. And Frufu used to belong to Dantech, but I now have Frufu, and Frufu is the last frugal. True story.
Uh-huh. Now, also speaking of keeping frugals safe, I want to get back to my story about keeping information safe. As I was saying that before the break, until Orbit rudely interrupted me with her knowledge, you know, college professors, right? Just because they went to school and paid for it and stuff, they think they need to teach you stuff. But, you know, whatever. So never mind that I learned this in school, too. That's totally beside the point. So before we left the story, the USB drives were scattered in places where the employees would find them. And so the guys with the security firm sat back and waited. Don't remember the exact numbers, but I want to say something like 18 out of 20 USB drives which were left laying around were picked up and accessed. And so, you know, curiosity got the best of these people. They find a USB drive. Of course, you want to find out what's on it, right? So, you know, they put them in their computers. The system-specific information and other files were transferred to the computers of the security firm guys. So let that be a lesson to you. Be very careful with things like that. This is a good example of social engineering. So be careful. Never give out your password to anybody. Don't, you know, don't mention it to anybody, especially over the internet. If you keep a list of your passwords, don't keep them by your computer, that sort of thing. So always be careful. You know, we take that kind of stuff for granted because we use them all the time, passwords everywhere, get very casual, but it's best to be safe.
But it's even better to be free. I don't know why I responded that way. I was just imagining some meme on Facebook about, I think, Benjamin Franklin saying that those who, or maybe Jefferson, something about those who seek freedom over liberty deserve either. I don't know. I don't even know if it's a real quote, but I see the meme all the time.
Yeah, that is actually by Benjamin Franklin, I believe. Those who would give a little bit of liberty for a little bit of freedom deserve neither, and shall have neither, something like that.
For security, yeah.
Yeah.
I hate memes, by the way. They make me angry.
I like them. They're fun. And, you know, I mean, they've existed for forever, but now it's just synonymous with the internet meme.
I know, but the way Facebook does them, and the vast majority of them are, like, either, like, intellectually false or quite honestly sexist or racist.
Well, yeah, Facebook stuff. Facebook is so full of misinformation with all those shared posts. Like, when in doubt, just, you know, doubt the post that you see, you know. When in doubt, doubt.
I actually spend more time debating on Facebook than I do on RF because of the stupid memes they get shared.
Mm-hmm.
Such a troll on Facebook.
Yeah, those shared posts, they're just like those chain emails that, you know, people, I guess, don't really get them much anymore, but they used to, you know, watch out for this virus, you know, delete this file in your computer, which turns out it's actually a file you need, you know. So much like that on Facebook now.
Speaking of Facebook, we actually need someone to be the social media representative of Radio RF on Facebook, Twitter, and what was the other one? Facebook, Twitter, and maybe LinkedIn? I don't know. You know, whatever. We need some social... So I suck at social media. I hate it. It makes me angry. And I just want to fight with people when I'm on Facebook.
Me too. So please... send your resumes to us, you know, resumes, CVs, anything like that, be much appreciated, and we may give you an interview.
Yes, an interview, and then you could be a regular contributing member to Radio RF by running our Facebook page, our Twitter account, our LinkedIn account. I don't even know if LinkedIn is the right one. It wasn't there when I had listed.
Well, we are professional here, and LinkedIn is a professional social media site, so it's only appropriate.
Yes, professional.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I think that's a show. Should I play a song? I downloaded a song today to play. You guys want to hear a song?
I don't know. I'm not sure we have enough time for a song.
It's 28, and you have a couple minutes. I have nothing else to say to you. Anything else to say? We could end the show now, but...
We could end the show now. Heck, we could be, like, spontaneous and on the edge and just go a little bit over an hour.
We do that every episode.
That's true. So does that mean it'd be more spontaneous to not go over an hour?
Yeah.
Yes. But I don't want to do that either. I paid good money to have a damn hour. I am going to use it. Well, all right. Well, man paid good money.
Yes, our benefactor, well named.
We have had other people donate, but he is our major contributor right now. And if you want to contribute, there's a link found in my signature on RF, so you can listen to that. Or you can click on that link while you listen to What Do You Put Your Faith In by Dionysius.
Yes, and if you donate within the next week,
born a poor child from nowhere, father died while he was still young, supported the family till he was 30. By then his ministry had begun. Such wisdom, the teachers were dumb. The rumors spread like cancer. The question of salvation for the chosen few. Said he was the only answer. He preached his good news to the poor and unseen.
Down Easiest, and the song was called What Do You Put Your Faith In? We wanted to thank you for submitting your songs, and we will be continuing to play a lot of songs by Down Easiest. He sent us a full album, actually, so we've been slowly playing through it. And if you want to submit your songs, art, poetry to Radio RF, please send a file to Dreadfisher Eye. And by the way, the picture of today's episode was by Orbit, and it's called The Mad Bard. And with that, I wanted to say good night, good morning, good afternoon.
And good now. And I also want to remind you that Radio RF goes to 11.